Hey, everybody. Welcome to Peck Underground Church. I am your host, Josh Peck. We have a very exciting guest for you tonight. And if you're not catching this live, the reason that you're able to watch it is because you became a member. Now, if you are watching this live, why is it important to become a member? Because YouTube has put a stranglehold on this channel so much. You've heard it from many other Christian and conservative YouTube channels. They just don't want us on our platform. So you know what you do? You just head on over to joshpeckdisclosure.com, click the members tab, and for $10 a month or $100 a year, you can become a member and get access to all the exclusive content available that we do, much of which is not available anywhere else. Now, tomorrow we have with us Brian Melvin. He's got a very interesting story. He's been doing this for 20 years or so, I think. He had a vision of hell, or he went to hell and he escaped. He came back. Jesus saved him. Well, we're going to get the whole story, and we're going to make sure that we set aside time for Q&A, because I know you have questions, as do I, and that's going to be an interesting conversation. After that, on the 15th, we have Joe Horn. We're going to talk about his new book, Champions. That's going to be excellent. And the very next day, the 16th of March, we have Stan Deo on schedule. It'll be his first time here. Speaking of first times, our guest tonight, it is his first time on Peck Underground Church, though he and I go back a few years. I have not had the opportunity or honor to interview him yet. So I'm excited to introduce my good friend, Joel Richardson. How you doing, Joel?
I'm doing very good. Thanks so much for having me on, Josh.
Yeah, definitely. I appreciate you taking the time to be on. You have a couple of new books out, which is, it's interesting for an author to release two books relatively around the same time, yet they're completely different topics. And I'm really excited that we get to talk about both of them tonight.
Yeah, they are very different, relatively very different topics. One had sort of, I've been working on it for a couple of years, and then the other one just happened all of a sudden last year. So they both came out around the same time.
Fantastic. Well, let's just jump right in. I assume probably most people, they've got to be familiar with you by now. If they're not, they need to come out of the rock that they've been living under for so long. But let's start with, you have this new book, Mystery of Catastrophe. And you have a co-author on this one, Nathan Graves. So I know Nathan wrote the introduction. And you know, I always have a hard time when I co-author a whole bunch of books with a whole bunch of people. And when I do interviews, a lot of times people don't know which parts I wrote and which parts my co-author wrote. So sometimes they'll ask me a question about what the co-author wrote and I can't answer it. So if you were to introduce the book, how would you introduce Mystery of Catastrophe for somebody who's just brand new? They don't know anything about this book except the title right now.
Yeah, I mean, and to be honest with you, it's kind of an unusual title. I don't know that the title necessarily gives it away, but essentially I would describe it as a manual for the end times. You know, when we talk about the end times, oftentimes I'll say, or let's say end time books, they're often end time trivia. You know, what are the details concerning the end times? And we do a bit of that. We do get into some of the details of the end times. This is less of a what's going to happen and more of a how should we respond to all of the things that are coming. And we discuss some real, just, you know, real world applicational issues. And it's very relevant, I would say. And I would say sort of behind a lot of what we were doing is we're trying to confront. Now, I want to qualify something before I say this.
Sure.
I'm very conservative. I believe in political activism, but we're trying to confront the overly politicized atmosphere to where Christians are interpreting almost every event that happens, almost every political issue, every geopolitical issue, every natural disaster through the lens of politics.
Yeah.
And what we're saying is, we need to learn how to interpret these things first as followers of Jesus, and then through politics second. And so that's really what this is learning how to see the events that are unfolding in our day and that will continue to unfold in increasingly in the days ahead, and how to approach those as followers of Jesus.
That brings up a really interesting point, because this is something that I've kind of struggled with too, and I've gone kind of back and forth, more on one side than more on the other side. When it comes to politics, I'm very conservative as well, and I'm passionate about it, which a lot of people think that that's like an oxymoron, conservatism and passion, but it's not. Where is that balance? Because we should never let our political passions or beliefs or views overshadow the great mission, all the stuff that Jesus wants for us. How we as Christians, when is too much too much? When do we take it too far? How do we find a balance between our political beliefs and our faith?
Well, I would say, when our primary concern, when our primary focus, when our first response is to think about how can we protect ourselves? How can we preserve our own way of life? How can we save ourselves, save our family, save our country? Now, again, all those things are fairly natural. On the other hand, the gospel calls us to lay down our lives for the salvation of others. Right. And so when we see that our immediate response is to, again, respond according to politics, rather than saying, how can the gospel go forward in this particular situation? What might God be doing in this particular situation? Let me give you an example, Josh. We cover a lot of examples in the book. We cover the example of Joseph in the Bible. This is the story of a guy whose brothers sold him into slavery. Now, if you were to say at the front end of that, if you were to say God's in this, people will say, what in the world are you talking about? You're trying to say that God supports human trafficking? You're talking about human trafficking, you're talking about slavery, and you're saying God's in this? And the fact of the matter is, the answer is yes, he was. Because when all was said and done, Joseph looks at his brothers and he goes, what you guys intended for evil, God intended for your salvation. And so he was able, in retrospect, when all was said and done, he was able to look at all of the events, all of the pain, all of the tragedy that had unfolded in his life over these few decades. And he says, God was in this, and he had bigger plans. He had plans for salvation and all of it. And this is where, the book goes really deep. We deal quite extensively. My co-author, Nathan, has been a veteran missionary in the Balkans for 25 plus years now. And when we started writing this, it was in the midst of the Muslim refugee crisis. Mm-hmm. Well, again, as conservatives, during this period, any number of conservatives were just recycling videos of these, rampaging Muslims, articles about the Muslim rape crisis in Europe. And a lot of those things are true. A lot of those things sometimes would be fake news as well. It would be a video from, Syria 4 years ago, and they say, this is Paris today, or this sort of thing. That's not to say there's not all sorts of horrible things that are happening. But by and large, the conservative response was to say, we're against it, we're against it, we're against it, we're against it. Now, I agree that this is not a good thing. On the other hand, what we did is we said, what might God be doing? And how can we get involved? And so I had Nathan back then. I had Nathan on my show, my little underground YouTube show. And we put out an appeal, and we raised close to $100,000.
Wow.
And I got to say this. If I put out an appeal for my own ministry, I raised $300. But we put out an appeal for the gospel, and people responded. It was between $50,000 and $100,000. And so what we did is we purchased tens of thousands of micro SD cards, and we loaded them up with Bibles in multiple languages, in Farsi, Persian, Arabic, Kurdish, and several different languages, and all sorts of Christian literature in different languages. And then as they were coming through, Nathan organized all of these churches in the Balkans, evangelical churches. And what they did is they set up at these checkpoints, they set up cell phone recharging stations. And so, of course, the refugees would stop. They would want their cell phones charged. And they would say, we have these micro SD cards. It has the Bible in your language. It has Christian literature. Would you like one of these in your phone? Mm-hmm. And about 95, 97% said yes. So we were able to get the Bible. We've been praying for years, Lord, let's reach the Middle East with the gospel. And all of a sudden he's bringing them to us. And so we were able to get the Bible into, I mean, literally tens of thousands of hands, and again, ask their permission to do so. And as a result of this, now people say, but I'm against it. You know, you should have been stopping them. Look, the government is going to do it. That's their responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Christians aren't just going to set up walls and say, we're going to stop you, you know, turn around, go back. These are people, many of whom are fleeing for their lives with their family and so forth. And not all of them are terrorists.
Right.
You know, but the point is that as a result of this, Nathan, just a few months ago, he visited a church where there was about 20 new believers that had come in because of this initiative. And, you know, we could go to several different churches in the area where there are new believers as a result of what we did. So this is what we're talking about, is having a gospel first focus, because ultimately, you know, the gospel is the inside out, upside down, backwards sort of thing. But it says he who seeks to save his life will lose it.
That's right.
And he who seeks to lose it for the sake of my kingdom will gain it. And so this is really what we're getting to, is Christianity 101.
Yeah, definitely. And I see a lot of lacking in that. I mean, there's a lot of times that, you know, I'll do a show or do an interview, or, you know, especially on this show that I co-host with Donna Howell, he's Tom Horn's daughter, Chalk Talk, where a lot of the things that we cover on that show, it's supposed to be, you know, what things that Christians don't know about their own Bibles, you know. But a lot of times that we cover topics, it's usually Christianity 101 kind of stuff. You know, it's usually this kind of basic stuff that we should all know, but for some reason we don't. And you know, when it's hard to recognize even the world that we live in, it's hard to recognize, you know, the spiritual world or the Christian reality of our faith. You have a chapter in here called A World of Catastrophe. How do you view the world today, and what can we as Christians do to turn it into something more profitable for the gospel?
Well, essentially, you know, I demonstrate in one of the chapters that I worked on, and by the way that we organize the book is we've got parts that say, this is written by Nathan, this is written by Joel, but we really worked on all of it somewhat together. I mean, the parts that have his name on it, he did most of the work, but we did interact a bit, and we worked a lot, by the way, to make our writing style flow together. But essentially, in one of the chapters, I talk about the fact that, and this is important, is that statistically, catastrophes are increasing. Because what you'll have is you'll have some people say, well, no, look, catastrophes are cyclical, whether we're talking natural disasters, wars, all of these things, they're no different today than they have been at any time in human history. The only difference today is that we have more sensors. You know, so when it comes to things like earthquakes, we're aware of them more. We have better recording technology, and that's true. But despite that, catastrophes, global natural disasters of all different kinds, natural and man-made, are increasing in both frequency and intensity. Now, why is that important? Well, it's important because in Matthew 24, Jesus used the analogy of birth pains, and he said the closer that we get to his return, that there would be birth pains. His return, the day of the Lord, that's the birth. That's what we're all looking forward to. But before that, the birth pains increase in frequency and intensity. That's the way birth pains are. You know, you start out with the Braxton Hicks, and then eventually you get to the real contractions. And this is what we're seeing in the earth today. And so if these things are going to increase, and if we're going to see more of them, we have to be a people ready and have a missions plan, a strategy, how we are going to continue to live as Christians and to complete the Great Commission as these things explode across the earth.
Yeah, and we got a lot of enemies at our feet too. And you know, Ephesians 6 tells us that our enemy is a spiritual one. You know, we wrestle not against flesh and blood. And one of those spiritual enemies is the spirit of Antichrist, which you deal with quite extensively in this book as well. How does the spirit of Antichrist play into this whole thing?
Well, essentially, what I articulate is this: I say, look, of all of the various tribulations that will come in the last days, again, natural and man-made. Jesus specifically, actually it goes back to the prophet Jeremiah, talks about it. And then the angel Gabriel talks about it in Daniel chapter 11 and 12. And he says, at that time, there will be a tribulation such as has never been since like the beginning of the world until that time. He goes, this will be unparalleled. And then Jesus essentially paraphrases that and reiterates it. And since there was a nation until that time, this is the worst. This is the worst of all distresses or tribulations. And you could say ultimately this applies to Israel, but he specifically says it's the worst that there has ever been. So if that's the case, what are we talking about? Well, in context, it's talking about the tribulation of the Antichrist, the persecution against the people of God from this last days empire, this last day's religious, geopolitical, military force. This will be the worst. And so then I get into saying, okay, well, what is it? And the fact of the matter is, even right now, even right where we are, just the past couple of years, there's been a handful of studies. There's more martyrdom, there's more persecution of Christians in the earth right now than at any time in history. You go, wait a minute, what are we talking about? There's actually more persecution of Christians now than ever before in terms of just numbers. And when you go down the top, really like 40 top nations where Christians are being persecuted, the majority of them are Muslim majority nations. And there's a few, you know, there's a few chart toppers like North Korea, not South Korea, North Korea, and, you know, China and a few others, but the vast majority are Muslim majority nations. And the thing of it is that's not going to change. You know, there's not just a day all of a sudden where the Muslims of the world are just going to roll over, the radical Muslims of the world are going to roll over. And to be clear, it's not all Muslims. You know, there's a radical percentage that is causing all of this, or we'll say just a little bit more zealous percentage. And, you know, I argue that Islam is the single greatest challenge that the church will face before the return of Jesus. And if that's the case, then we need to rise to meet that challenge. And we've been living with our head in the sand for too long. I think we're a good 15, 20 years behind the curve on this. We need to be aware of what's coming. We're not unaware of the schemes, the wiles of the devil, and we need to have a game plan. We need to be prepared.
I completely agree with you. Sorry about that. I completely agree with you. And that's what I appreciate about works like this, because you don't only just show the problem and then leave no solution. You talk about what paths we can take. What would you want most for people to take away from the mystery of catastrophe?
I want people to learn how to ask different questions, to learn how to ask the right questions first, to always ask that question, what might God be doing here? What might the gospel opportunity be here? Rather than saying, you know, who's right, who's wrong, what is the sort of stock conservative response? What's the meme that I can retweet or post on Facebook to tell everybody that they're idiots? You know, this sort of thing. You get so many Christians and they're just like, you know, you don't understand. I'm going to raise my voice in the public square. And I go, no, you're not. You're griping on Facebook. You know what I mean? Like, you're not doing anything. You're upsetting your friends and neighbors. And, you know, yeah, you might be right. You might be completely right. In most cases you are, but you know, I want people to be focused on the right things. I want people to be focused on the gospel. And again, it's not to say that politics are not important. It's an issue of prioritization. What takes priority in our life? And the gospel has to take priority.
Yeah, I totally agree. That's been a major focus of my ministry too, because I see so much, especially in, like, you know, like YouTube comments or Facebook. Yeah, it's not as, I mean, it is on Facebook too, but Facebook, you're not as anonymous as you can be on YouTube. YouTube is where I really see, well, and Twitter also, but for me personally, I'm not that active on Twitter. I am a little bit, but I'm really active on YouTube. And man, some of the most vile things that the human heart can produce will come out in a YouTube comment, and over nothing, over a difference of opinion from supposed Christians. So yeah, I mean, the things that we focus on are just so petty and small and ridiculous compared to what Jesus gave us, the gospel and what he did for us, dying on the cross for us so that we might have salvation. I mean, all of these little petty things I mean, you know, we as Christians will fight about the most ridiculous, like who's the Antichrist or which rapture theory is true. And it's like, okay, we can have discussions and we should, because, but those should be fun discussions. You know, we should be curious. We shouldn't be confused. We should be curious. And those can always be enlightening. Like I, for example, what, you know, the lineage of the Antichrist, who the Antichrist might be. I've always found that to be an interesting conversation. Your work, your past work has very much been a big part of that for me. I've always found that, like the Islamic Antichrist idea, I've always found to be very interesting, very well put together. It makes a lot of sense to me. There's other ideas that I find interesting too. And the whole thing to me, it's kind of like reading just a really good mystery novel, you know? And when we get to our eternal state, then we'll find out the end. We'll see how it all played out and we're going to be amazed. But until then, it's like, well, you know, enjoy the ride. And of course, you know, people might say, well, how can you enjoy the ride when things are so terrible? And, you know, there's all these bad things that happen. And, you know, just read the book of Revelation and you're going to get at least a mild state of depression out of it. but the way I look at it is like, well, no, you don't have to. It's not presented for that reason, because keep reading, you know, find out what happens after all of that. Everything gets restored. There's a good outcome. So that's kind of where I'm at with it.
I just had Josh, I got to tell you this.
Yeah.
So I did a video and I talked about Nimrod. And I talked about how a lot of the things that we believe about Nimrod come from extra biblical traditions and the Catholic Church, you know, as a Protestant, as a child of the Reformation, I have a lot of problems with the Catholic Church, but it is not the religion of Nimrod.
Right.
And I sort of went through all this. I go, you know, I've got all these problems, and I listed a few. It was not a bash Catholicism show, but I was just saying, like, we need to have. And someone posted a comment that said that I obviously must be a quote Vatican loving homo. And again, you know, this kind of thing, I'm going,
did they need to add the homo thing? What does that really add to, you know, after all that? I know I've gotten that a lot too. I've gotten somebody that said, and they always use the word obviously you must be. Well, if we must be, then why are you saying obviously if it's so obvious that everybody would agree anyway, you know? But I had this one, it was on it was probably some Antichrist thing or something. It was something that I was doing about Bible prophecy, and it rubbed somebody the wrong way. It was something that I was kind of pro-Israel on it, you know, and I was saying, hey, you know, we should probably pray for our you know, Jewish friends over there that they you know, learn about their Messiah, and wouldn't that be great? And, you know, then we can all be together in the kingdom, and how amazing would that be? You know, I just took kind of a, you know, that approach, and this guy was like, this guy commented and said, well, obviously. And at first I thought he was saying this just to be a troll and he didn't really believe it. But then he started saying it more and more and more for like a month. But he's like, obviously you're a transvestite. You were a woman. You married a man. That's Christina. And you guys got this weird transvestite like marriage going on. And I, he put it a little more eloquently than I am right now, but he presented his case with that. And I left it up because I was like, all right, well, you know, whatever. I thought he was just saying that because, you know, he's just trying to be insulting. But then he kept it up and he kept bringing evidence. You know, he kept bringing little like quotes of things that he was researching my YouTube channel to try to prove this ridiculous theory about me. And I had to wonder, you know, what does sexuality have anything to do with, you know, views in Bible prophecy and stuff like that? It's interesting that they called you a homo over it. My co-author, Stephen Bancars, they did that to him too. They told him he was a gay Jew boy who was still involved in the New Age or something. And he had several people telling him that. Very strange, YouTube commenter.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, what can you do? Well, that's probably as good of a segue as any to get into your next book, Mount Sinai. So, Mount Sinai in Arabia, this has been a contentious topic. There are a lot of people that wonder where the true location of Mount Sinai is, and many people are convinced it's in the traditional site. You have you have a different idea that I like, and I actually think I agree with you on this. I agree with you on a lot of stuff, but I think this falls in that category as well. So before we get into this, what first prompted you to want to write about this, and what can you tell us about what the traditionally accepted site of Mount Sinai actually is?
Yeah, so the traditional site is down there in the southern Sinai Peninsula. So you're talking the pizza-shaped peninsula that sits in between Egypt and the Arabian Peninsula. And really, that location, it was in the 4th century AD that some of these Egyptian Christian monks ironically started fleeing the corruption of modern society in Egypt and going out into the desert. This is the beginning of the Saint Anthony and the monastics, the desert fathers, as they're often referred to. And so these praying hermits and monks, they just kind of determined that this particular mountain was Mount Sinai, but there was really no biblical, archaeological, or traditional reason for that. It was sort of just a tradition that developed among them. And then you had a couple journals of some pilgrims that came, and they talk about how the monks explain that this is the mountain. Well, then what would happen is as these monks were down there praying in the mountain, they would build these shacks and just themselves to, asceticism and fasting and prayer and starving and, all of that good kind of Catholic beating yourself into holiness, that the what were called the Saracens or the Ishmaelites every now and then would come through and kill a whole bunch of them. And so it was in the 5th century, the 500s, so really the 6th century, that Emperor Justinian built what's called St. Catherine's Monastery, which is a fortress. It was, you're talking 50-foot high walls to protect these monks. And the full name of it is St. Catherine's Monastery of the God-Trodden Mountain. Okay, so the idea is now the full authority of the Roman Empire, the Catholic Church, put their stamp of approval on this as Mount Sinai. And so now you've got tradition, you've got compounding error, you've got building tradition. So that's the only reason people believe it's Mount Sinai. Again, there's no biblical, archaeological, there's no real historical evidence for it. It's really just a very, elaborate tourist trap. And it's been an interesting place in terms of preserving various Christian manuscripts and art and icons and, historical tidbits. But it's not Mount Sinai. Again, there's no real evidence for that. Your second question, I forget what was your second question. Oh, why write the book? So, then there's this alternative spot over there on the east side of the Red Sea in Saudi Arabia. And of course, in 1984, Ron Wyatt is the first modern guy who really went over there and started bringing attention to this. And then you had Bob Cornuke, and then you had Jim and Penny Caldwell in the 90s went there a whole bunch of times and filmed and got all kinds of video and so forth. They eventually shared that footage with both Ron and Bob. And then I'll just say this, as sort of the messiness behind it, then there was a lot of territorialism. And so you had camps. You had the Bob Cornuke camp. You had the Ron Wyatt camp and a lot of name calling, a lot of accusations, a lot of this sort of thing. And, as a result of all of this, I think a lot of scholars and different folks really wanted nothing to do with it. They thought it was just a sensational idea that didn't have a lot of, archaeological weight and this sort of thing behind it. I had seen some of the videos, some of the footage, and I was fascinated by it. And I had really prayed. I had prayed a few times. I said, Lord, if you would open up the opportunity, I'd really love to get into Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is closed, and soon it will open, but it's been closed. You can't get in. And so when I had the opportunity to get in, to get a work visa, to do some assist with some photography work for promotional work for a company, then you can go and you can do some hiking. And so I had the opportunity to do that. And so that's when I really started working through all of the scholarly literature, all of the critical literature, and there's all kinds of articles online. And they really treat this as though it's a complete crackpot, goofball, sensationalist idea that has no legitimate historical, archaeological, or traditional weight behind it. Okay, but the more that I read, the more that I saw this incredible energy, a lot of personal attacks, a lot of ad hominem attacks, and a lot of bad arguments. And so when I started looking at the good arguments, I just said, you know something, this is a classic example of a few scholars who are obviously upset that a couple of non-scholars ultimately are bringing attention to probably the single greatest archaeological site in modern times. I mean, in almost in terms of all of biblical history, Mount Sinai, I mean, this is absolutely huge. And so there's been a lot of scholarly bullying, a lot of just, you know, sort of chest thumping and pointing down and mockery. And I just said something needs to be written that lays out the case that interacts with all of the scholarly literature, which I did. I really worked through everything from, you know, scholarly journals to all of the books that have been written. And just lay it out in a very simple, easy to understand way so that people can recognize the fact that this is not a crackpot idea, that it's actually, of all the candidates out there, and there's several different mountains that have been suggested, that this is by far the single best candidate. And it really makes sense to the point where if this is not the real Mount Sinai, then God himself has set up an incredibly elaborate hoax.
Wow, that's pretty huge. I know we don't have a whole lot of time, so it's difficult to boil down such a big topic in such a short amount of time. But where do you see Mount Sinai as, and what is your best evidence for that case?
So it's an argument that's built upon several different layers. But let me just start by saying this: Moses was in Midian. And it says in Genesis 3, verse 1, that he was tending his father-in-law Jethro's sheep, the flocks, and he went to the far side of the desert, and he came to the mountain of God. So the inference is that this was not tremendously far from Midian, but it was on the other side of a desert. There was a desert that lay in between Midian and the mountain of God. And so you begin with this basic idea because Midian, scholarly consensus places it over there on the eastern side of the Gulf of Aqaba. Now, if you're dealing with the traditional site, Moses would have had to gone on roughly a 500-mile round trip to feed the sheep. Not very likely.
Right.
Not very likely. The location that we're looking at is more like a 40-mile round trip, 20 miles each way or so, give or take 5 miles. And that's reasonable. That's a pretty good hike to go feed the sheep.
Yeah.
20 miles across the desert, that's a pretty good hike. And that's reasonable. That makes sense. So first of all, we're dealing with the general region of Midian. And there's all sorts of archaeological evidence behind that, biblical evidence, again, scholarly consensus. Then you get into issues of where was the Red Sea crossing. The Bible calls it the Yam Suf. Yam means ocean. Suf is there's a few different possibilities in terms of what that means. Well, the Bible says every time it names the Yam Suf and it gives it geographical identifications, it's the Gulf of Aqaba. Not the other side, not the Suez, it's the Gulf of Aqaba. It says that Solomon built a fleet of ships at Ezion Geber by Eloth. That's Eilat. That's the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, the Red Sea. Okay, so this is the right sea. So, you know, the Gulf of Aqaba is where the sea crossing took place. It's close to the land of Midian. And then you have this very ancient, and this is something that I found. I only found it in a few, you know, fairly obscure references. There's this guy named Alan Kirkeslager, who's a scholar. Back in the 90s, he wrote this. It was in a collection, a scholarly collection on really different, a few different topics. But essentially, there's this very ancient Jewish tradition that pertains to the location of Midian and the location of Mount Sinai. And the first place that we see this is in the Septuagint, so the Greek translation of the Old Testament. This is about 250 years before Jesus. And in the Septuagint, first of all, they treat the land of Midian like a city. The Bible calls it the land of Midian. This is where Jethro lived. This is where Moses lived. This is close to the mountain of God. And we know that it treats it like a city for a few different reasons. It talks about when Jethro went out of Midian to go visit Moses, it says that he went out. Now, that's the language of you go out of the city, out into the desert, out into the wilderness. And that's sort of an addition to the translation of the Septuagint. Second, when it talks about the elders of Midian, it specifically uses a Greek phrase, which is normally it means city councilors, literally city councilors. And then finally, you have these variations that when the Septuagint comes to the name Midian, it always has one of two variations, either Madian or Madium. You know, why is that important? Because in the first century, all within the same time period, you had this very well-known Roman geographer, Claudius Ptolemy, and he lists two cities over there in northwest Saudi Arabia on the eastern side, eastern coast of the Red Sea, called Modium and Madian. Okay, so there was clearly a well-known tradition or understanding in the first century during Jesus's time that that was where Midian was. And then you have, okay, so there's the Septuagint. That's a substantial source of Jewish understanding. Then you have Philo and Josephus. They were both in the first century. Philo was from Alexandria, so this may have been more of a Jewish Alexandrian tradition. Josephus, more of a Jerusalemite tradition. And they both say that Mount Sinai was the tallest mountain in the district or outside of Midian. Well, again, Jebel al-Lawz, this is the mountain that we're talking about, is about 20 miles from the town of Al-Bad, which is really the only candidate that we have for ancient Midian. And the reason I say it's the only candidate, because that whole area over there east of the Red Sea, this entire area of northwest Saudi Arabia, in that region, there's two oasis towns. One is called Magna. It's right on the coast. The other one's 20 miles inland from Magna, and it's called Al-Bad. It was an oasis, and it was on the Arab caravan route. Other than that, there are no oases in the area. There's no place to live. That's the only place they would have lived, and that's the place where they find all of the archaeology, all of the pottery, and they call it Midianite pottery, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the most natural place, 20 miles outside of that. The tallest mountain is called Jebel al-Lawz, which means the Mountain of Almonds. And Josh, what do the locals call this mountain? They call it the Mountain of Moses.
Wow.
And they believe, the locals believe that this is Mount Sinai. So I always have to point out the fact that, yes, Ron Wyatt was the first guy that brought our attention to it, but he did not discover it because it was never lost. We in the West lost it because we're focused on this alternative tradition. You know, but the fact of the matter is it's never been lost. The Muslims actually, after this Jewish tradition, then you have Eusebius, Jerome, and a handful of other early Christians that also affirm that this is where it was. And eventually the Muslims, when they came along, they just carried this tradition on in the 7th century. And to this very day, there is this unbroken tradition that goes all the way back to 300 years before Jesus that says that this is the real Mount Sinai.
Man, that is fantastic. That's what gets me excited about this kind of stuff, and especially, you know, in terms of Bible prophecy, because this would have all sorts of prophetic implications with it. I know we're running low on time, and I do want to do at least a few minutes of Q&A before we have to go. While people are getting ready their questions, so everybody who's viewing live right now, get your questions ready for Joel. Put them in the chat, and I will read them. While they're doing that, there's so much more in both of these two books that we haven't had time to cover. Where can people pick up these books, follow you online, watch your show, and everything Joel Richardson? Where can they go?
So my website is joelstrumpet.com. I've got a YouTube channel called The Underground with Joel Richardson. You just type in Joel Richardson, it pops up. I've just got a little YouTube show that I do there. And then I'm on Twitter at Joel7Richardson. If you want to get any of the books, a signed copy, you can go to my website at joelstrumpet.com, or you can get them on Amazon.
Fantastic. And I highly suggest to my audience that you go and do that. Obviously, Joel is, I probably should have mentioned it in the beginning of the show instead of the end, but he's a best-selling author for very good reason. He's extremely talented and a very thorough researcher. You will not be disappointed. If you have a question, go ahead and put it in the chat right now. We'll get to Q&A. I did see one pop up. Actually, it came up again, so this works out great. I don't know who originally asked it, but this time it is Rick Haberman, who is asking it. Thoughts on Jared Kushner and the Mideast peace plan? What do you think about that? And do you think that there's any connection between Jared Kushner and this Antichrist figure that we read about in the Bible?
No, I don't. And this is the thing is, you know, one of the biggest mistakes among premillennialists, those who believe the Antichrist is yet future, one of the biggest mistakes that we do is Antichrist pointing. Mm-hmm. So we go, well, here's a guy. He's got good hair. And he's talking about a peace plan. He must be the Antichrist.
Right.
Well, you know, what does the scripture say about the Antichrist? The scripture is clear that he's the king of the north. He's the Assyrian. He's from the tri-state area. What do I mean by that? Iraq, Syria, Turkey. Repeatedly over and over and over again, the scriptures are clear that that's the region that he comes from. I'm always leery of any effort to engage in some sort of a Middle East peace plan, but if I were to hazard to guess, nothing is going to come of this. I think the covenant with many, Daniel 9, 26, 27, you know, that covenant that's coming, I think it's yet down the road a little bit. That said, you know, it's something that we need to keep our eye on, but I do not think that Jared Kushner is the Antichrist.
Yeah, very, very good. Roddy K is asking, question for Joel. Does he think Mohammed bin Salman's planned construction for the city Neom will endanger Jabal al-Lahz and destroy the archaeological evidence that this place is the real Mount Sinai? Very good question.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of news articles talking about this, a lot of concern, and the answer is no. Behind, I've got a lot of conversation going with the Saudis. And believe me, they know what they have. They've been protecting it and preserving it for years. You'll see all this stuff online. Well, they put these fences up because they're trying to hide biblical truth. No, they're trying to keep us crazy Americans out from going over there and digging for gold and destroying things.
Right.
You know, and they've done a good job at protecting it. And by the way, this city is as big as the entire state of Israel.
Wow.
Okay, so there's plenty of room. It's not like they're going to put buildings right next to Mount Sinai. This thing's way out in the boons. And they're going to turn it into a park. You know, they're going to turn the whole area into a very large park. They're going to welcome in tourists. This is going to be fantastic for them financially. And the Quran, by the way, their own traditions talk about Mount Sinai and Moses and Jethro. They call Jethro Shu'aib. So this is good for them, and it's good for us. We get to go over and get inspired and have our minds blown by the fact that the God of the Bible is true. All of the craziest stuff that you've read about, God ripping the ocean in half, coming down in fire, it's all there. It's all historical. It all happened. It will inspire your faith. And they get all of our tourism dollars. So, I mean, it's a win-win for everyone. And, you know, by the way, when we were there, you have the split rock of Moses. That thing is incredible. We ran into a bunch of Pakistani guys, and we started talking to them. We told them about it. They were so excited they came with us. And so, you know, even these Muslims were thrilled to go check it out, and they were in awe. And, you know, I have no question that Christians, Muslims, and Jews are going to – this is going to become one of the biggest religious tourism spots in the world over the next 10 years.
Right, that's great. You actually answered somebody else's question, because somebody else asked, what does Joel know about any future plans to make this a tourist attraction? I've heard rumors, and you answered that. So that's great. Well, that'll be an interesting time for sure. Helena M. is asking, where is the Ark of the Covenant, also known as the Ark of the Testimony? What are your thoughts about the Ark of the Covenant, Joel?
I have it.
You have it.
I have it.
The location is in your heart.
No, look, this is a tremendous mystery. You know, again, Ron Wyatt says that it's there under the Garden Tomb there in Jerusalem. Then there's this possible Ark of the Covenant down there in Ethiopia. You know, it's anybody's guess. You know, who knows? Maybe it'll end up being found down there by Mount Sinai. You know, we really don't know. Nobody knows for sure. The thing of it is, with what Ron said, if you hear his stories, like, the thing of it is either it's there or he's a liar.
Right.
He didn't really give us any room for something in between. He says that he saw it down there under the Garden Tomb. And, of course, they've closed it off now. No one really has access to it. some people speculate and say some of the rabbis know where it is. And, you know, because apparently you can access some of those tunnels under the Temple Mount. I really don't know. I'm fascinated. I believe someday we probably will find it.
Yeah, I believe so too. And I think that is going to be an amazing day. Well, this has been an absolute blast. I know we're running low on time. Joel, I cannot thank you enough for coming on. We're going to have to do this again because I've learned a lot, and I know the audience has too. And yeah, this is very exciting stuff. Thank you for writing these books and for coming on the show.
All right. Hey, thanks so much for having me, Josh. I'd love to come back on and chat with you some more.
Absolutely, will do. Hang on the line. I'll close us out here. So everybody, you have heard it. Make sure you go and check out Joel Richardson's work. Also, very special thank you to Thrivolous Z for giving a generous $10 donation through Super Chat. Thank you. He's saying this $10 is because I'm glad to see you back, Josh. Love a man. Hey, I love you too, brother. Thank you for supporting us. And thank all of you for supporting us. Right now, the best way you can do that is to go to joshpeckdisclosure.com and become a member. Also, we are adding new shows. It's not just going to be me. It's not just going to be Peck Report and Peck Underground Church. We're getting a couple new shows. Still a little early to talk too much about it, but you're going to be thrilled. You're going to want to become a member. So the time to do that is now. This is how we're just going to have to fight YouTube censorship. We're going to have to get off of YouTube and have our own platforms by ourselves. So we're going to do that. Go to joshpeckdisclosure.com for more information. Just click on the members tab. It's very easy to do. And while you're there, after you do that, make sure you go to Joel Richardson's site, pick up his books, watch his show, listen to his show, do all that. Follow him on Twitter and online. You got the links in the chat if you're viewing this live. And if not, he explained what they are before. So make sure you do that. All right, everybody, thank you so much. We will see you tomorrow with Brian Melvin. That is going to be an interesting conversation. I have a lot of questions about hell, and apparently he has seen it. So we'll see. And I'm sure you got questions too. That's going to be a fun conversation about hell, I guess. Fun and hell, you know, whatever. But it's going to be a good conversation. I'm excited for it. Love you all. Thank you so much for joining us. Take care and God bless.